If any one of those hit, the world's completely different. If all three hit, it's probably a world that you and I can't imagine right now.
Welcome, and thank you for listening to the Next Gen Podcast, a conversational series with members from Energen Wealth Partners at UBS. With an understanding of the family dynamics that can accompany multi-generational wealth, we are experienced in working with you and your family to develop a strategic plan to guide your decisions. Our approach helps provide education across generations to help define and support your long-term vision for your wealth. Welcome to the Next Gen Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Pfeiffer, Senior Wealth Strategy Associate with Energen Wealth Partners at UBS Financial Services in Dayton, Ohio. Today, we're honored to have Tony Himmelgarn, President and CEO of Siemens Digital Industry Software. Tony has been instrumental in driving Siemens' transformation into a global leader in digitalization, artificial intelligence, and cloud technology. In this episode, we'll dive into Tony's journey, from his early life and college years to leading one of the most innovative companies in the world. We'll explore Siemens' role in shaping the future of industry, how they leverage AI and cloud technology. And at the end here, we'll wrap up with Tony's advice to the next generation of leaders. Tony, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I want to go ahead and get started here with a little bit of your early life. So where did you grow up? You know, what things influenced your decision to pursue a path in technology? Was it something about how you grew up or what you did or family that encouraged you to go down that path? Or was this something that you just kind of found on your own and forged your way through?
Yeah, so I grew up in a very small town in Ohio called St. Henry, Ohio. It's about an hour and a half north of Dayton, right along the Indiana line. Lots of sports done there. So it's known for many pro athletes that have come out of a small little town of a couple thousand people. They're football players and so forth. And I did play football and baseball and other types of things there. But as far as the tech goes, really, it was more, I actually like to sketch and draw things, whatever. So when I was thinking about going to school, I saw this idea of drafting, engineering drafting and so forth. So I went down that path, went to a small school, went to a two-year school of Wright State. And they had a drafting and design technology program that I went through. And towards the end of the program was the first time I ever saw a CAD system, a computer-aided design system. So this is doing drawings essentially on a computer versus on a drawing board at that time.
Yeah.
And I started to play with it a little bit. I got interested and I kind of liked it. And then, you know, this is the very early 80s. And so when I went looking for a job, it wasn't the best time to look for a job. It was very difficult. And so applied a few places. And I remember there was an architecture firm in downtown Dayton that was going to hire me. But then I got a call from a company called CAD/CAM Incorporated in Dayton, Ohio. And I thought, well, wait a minute, I like this CAD stuff. Let me go talk to these guys and see what they've got. And it's crazy. I took a job with them working third shift because the technology was so expensive. You had to run it three shifts, right? You had to have people using it all the time to be able to pay it off. And I had to work six nights a week to get 40 hours because if everybody took a lunch break during the day, you didn't have a full 8 hours at night. And so it was a crazy experience. But I started using CAD systems there. And it was a service bureau. So what they did was design and drafting and detailing tech work for other companies. And they had multiple CAD systems there. One of the first systems we used was called Computer Vision, which is kind of interesting because now, all these years later, computer vision dominated in this space. They were the premier tool. They're not around anymore, right? And just right now, the tech can change.
How it's changed over time, yeah.
Right. And so in doing that, I saw it go from 2D drawings to 3D wireframe, if you can imagine, the kind of stick figures that you put together.
Sure.
The surface modeling, this would be like the shape of the hood of a vehicle, for example, is a surface that you might lay out. To full 3D solid modeling. And solid modeling is you treat it like you're modeling a solid part. And so those things have all transpired as I've been in the business. And I really like being on the CAD side of that business. And then at CAD/CAM Inc., I got a lot of different experience because there's multiple systems that we dealt with at the time.
Okay.
So that's kind of how I got involved with the tech of what I'm in today.
Sure. No, that's fantastic. So along the way, would you say there were any pivotal moments that really guided you? Was it that first draftsman job? Was it finally, you know, being introduced to CAD software that really drove you? Or was it just kind of enjoying it throughout the time and no real singular point that helped guide you or push you?
Well, look, it was exciting to be working on a computer to do drawings when most of the world was doing them on paper. And I did all my fair share of in college and so forth, drawing on paper. And you make a mistake on paper, you make a mistake, you get a erase, you got to start over. And a computer was, hey, this is a different experience, right? You could think a lot differently. And while I was working at CAD/CAM, I decided, hey, this drafting thing is going to go nowhere because it's all going to be replaced at time. And so I went to school at night at the University of Dayton to get an engineering degree. I went to school at night for 6 years, believe it or not.
Wow.
I was working during the day, trying to take classes at night, traveling. I was an application engineer, so I was out demoing and other types of things. And I had to travel a lot. Now, part of that was at CAD/CAM, and then I left and went to a company called Intergraph that was based out of, its headquarters were in Huntsville, Alabama. We had operations based out of Cincinnati, and I worked out of Mason for a long time, living in Dayton, driving to Mason. And so it took a while to get through that. But then what I saw was it wasn't in just 3D modeling. I mean, those are the things that we all think of. But then we started getting into simulation. So, for example, will this thing break when I bend it? I sit on that chair, is it going to hold me? All those kind of things. I mean, you can model those things. And it's called finite element analysis, where we can go in and really determine what is the best shape and the best way to design something to make it as light as possible, as strong as possible, for example.
Sure.
And then we got into things like fluid dynamics, to be able to show how air flows or water flows or any kind of liquid flows through some kind of vessel or whatever you're dealing with, you know, whether it's airflow across a vehicle and making sure that it's able to move through the air much more efficient than anything else. We've got into data management.
Yeah.
So you think about an automobile, there's probably 300,000 possible build combinations of an automobile, left, right hand drive, all the possible variants. And so we have a product that did all of that. So you start seeing all these pieces come together, and that technology started getting really interesting because you can think a lot of like data systems. And I think you being on the finance side of the world, you know, of ERP systems like SAP and these types of systems.
Yeah.
And while those are good to tech, of course, but you implement an ERP system, generally you get it finished and you kind of leave it alone. You don't want to touch it again.
Yeah.
And they're very similar in their implementations because you're solving financial issues and things like this. In our space in engineering, you're never finished. And the reason you're never finished is you can go to a company and say, I'm going to help you take 50% of your engineering cost out of this company to move faster, right? With our tools and our technology. The interesting part is you do that. And when you're all finished, you celebrate and, you know, it's a great job. And then they look at you and say, yeah, but we got to do it again. You never stop, right?
Yeah,
the tech never stops because we're in the space of innovation. Mm-hmm. In innovation, there's always looking for that other thing you're going to squeeze out to change. And so what I think were pivotal things for me was just seeing how the technology kept evolving. Because I remember doing the first time I did a 3D wireframe and I spun it on the screen. The guy behind me said, holy cow, why would you ever need any more than that? And now, if you look at what we're doing with 3D modeling, I just came back from the CES show in Las Vegas. And we're working with companies like NVIDIA to show how we use their GPUs to really do high performance rendering. We could always do it before, but this allows us to go really, really quick.
Another one.
So now it's like a gaming engine. It's like the games you've played with Nintendo and other types of systems where you're flying through that game real time, wherever you want to go. We're doing the same thing in 3D modeling with real true physics based models. These are real factories running real applications that I'm flying through, the true robotics of how it's running and everything. And so every time somebody wants to tell me that we've kind of reached a mature point of technology, you say, well, I've heard that over and over again over the last 40 years. And every time we turn around, somebody comes up with something new. That's what's interesting about this space and what we're doing.
No, absolutely. So one of the big questions that I have for you is you went from being a, you know, the engineer and running the CAD, and you talked about the innovation that's driven the industry. So that path from being the CAD driver and going on the road doing sales to being CEO of Digital Industry Software, that's a heck of a jump. That's a lot of steps that you went through over a lot of years there. Can you tell me a little bit more about the additions to that journey? I know you led a lot of accounts, Ford's global account, for example. What was that like working on that, the automotive side of things there for a little while, obviously helping them with their engineering needs? driving you towards becoming CEO?
Well, if you think there was some laid out plan that said I was going to be CEO, I can tell you that was not the case, right? It was really just working hard, staying close to the technology. Mm-hmm. It's kind of funny. When I was a kid at GM Inc., they kept wanting me to be a manager. I didn't want to be a manager. And the reason I didn't want was I saw managers and I thought, well, they don't have any technical skills. I wanted something I can fall back on, right? And I know the tech and I knew it very well. And eventually I left there and I went to a company called Intergraph, which is one of the pioneers in the space as well, as I mentioned earlier. And then they moved me to Detroit to be the regional technical director. And so I was here for a while, and then Intergraph was struggling a little bit as a tech company. Really what had transpired was, it's kind of a history lesson on tech and so forth, is we were selling hardware at the time that was so profitable, you could give the software away for almost free. Wow. Because there was so much profit in the hardware, right? And then when PCs and workstations came out, the profit was eroding very quickly. And so now suddenly you had to go back to those same customers and tell them, hey, all that software I gave you for free, it's now very, very valuable. Well, that's a hard transition. And Intergraph never really recovered. We were about a $1 billion software company in the early mid-90s and never really got out of that. And a lot of companies struggled with that transition. And so then I started looking, and I went to another company called SDRC, which is based out of Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. And they were a CAD pioneer as well. And they had a product for 3D visualization that I knew a little bit about, and I interviewed for it, and I went to work for them, and they wanted me to manage that 3D visualization contract with Ford. So I went there, and I knew a little bit about auto, but not that much, right? I mean, I knew enough to be dangerous, I guess, when it came to the true engineering aspects. So I started doing that, and I did the contract for a little while on 3D visualization, and then I took over the whole Ford account, was asked to run it, and I would say it's the most difficult job I've ever had. Because if you've never worked with an automotive company, they beat you up pretty badly. They're very demanding. And I was in right in the middle of deploying the tech that was leading edge, mm-hmm. of doing this CAD, CAMS, computer design, computer manufacturing software. Very, very difficult. The first week on the job, I went to a meeting, and it was, why is TeamCenter, one of our data management solutions, not meeting expectations?
Wow. Before. That's a heck of a meeting to walk into.
Right. It was me and probably about, I don't know, 5 or 6 vice presidents and a few directors or four and everything. And we met every Thursday for 4 hours for as long as I was there. And I was there for 7, 8, 9 years almost. And in those meetings, I was by myself. So I didn't get to bring an entourage with me. It was me. And you'd get beat up and you had to know your stuff, right? And so while I would say it was the hardest job I've ever had, I also learned a great deal. And frankly, now wherever I go in the world, wherever I deal with any issues or whatever, 90% of the time it's something I experienced once before at Ford and everything I did. So it helped a great deal. And then when I left Ford, or when I was asked to do more, I was asked to take on our vertical sales organization, which means traditionally we used to sell software kind of generically. We'd come in and sell you a 3D modeler, and whether you're building an automobile or a tennis shoe, we sold the same way.
Sure.
And then we realized, you know what, that really doesn't work. You need to speak the language of the industry that you're in. And so we created a vertical sales organization. I was asked to run it. Never wanted to be a salesperson. The reason I never wanted to be a salesperson, I'd spent enough time as an application engineer with salespeople, and I saw that it was probably one of the most unfair jobs in the world. What do I mean by that?
Yeah.
I've seen really, really good salespeople with the wrong product at the wrong time in the wrong territory starve. And I've seen people that I thought were not very good at all, right place, right time, and make a fortune. And so as a technical engineer and these kind of things, you look at it and say, well, this is crazy. You know, and I knew I could do it. I just didn't want to do it because I thought you don't control your destiny.
Sure.
In much of what you were doing there. And so, but I kept being told, hey, take it. So I took it on, and here suddenly I'm managing an entire sales force, and I never really carried a sales bag myself directly. But I knew enough about it because I'd ran with salespeople my whole life.
I've been around it, sure, yeah.
So we did that, and I did that for a long time, and then I ran the Americas then for us for a while, or North America mostly. And then I was asked to go run Europe. You talk about having a plan. The plan was simply a person that passed away that was running Europe for us, and they needed somebody to go do it. And I was asked to go do it, as we decided to go take a shot at that. Did that for a few years, and then my boss quit, so I had to come back to the U.S. and run worldwide sales. And did that for a while, and then eventually became CEO. And I've been CEO of the group. This is my 10th year of doing this. And we came into Siemens about 17 years ago because Siemens started to realize, hey, to be a tech company, we kind of like this software. What could we do with it? And initially, we were just a side attraction. We were not
okay. Yeah.
At all. But there was one man that had a vision that saw what we could do. And said, gosh, if you can do all this with software, it's going to be a threat to the rest of our business. How do we figure out how to leverage this? And I would say he was 15 years ahead of us at the time and what he saw. He was right. And now we've become very, very important to Siemens. We're a $6 billion business. We, again, almost 29,000 employees. And a big part of that was that transition that we went through the company to get there, and it's making a difference today.
Sure. Yeah. And that's absolutely incredible. And for those that don't know, can you kind of describe what Siemens is? So obviously a big, you know, engineering software, computer-aided design company, but there's so many other aspects to it. And can you kind of describe what Siemens' mission and impact is, other than what we can just see on the Siemens truck driving down the road or on the side of an X-ray machine, for example?
You know, first of all, Siemens, you know, is a very large conglomerate. So we've got kind of big pieces. One is automation. So automation is, if you go into a factory, you've got something called a PLC, a programmable logic controller, which controls motion and action and other types of things. So, you know, if you see a package being pushed on a conveyor or whatever, it might say, hey, execute and push at this time. It's a logic you build. So Siemens is very, very strong there. Major player in the world doing automation. The next part is buildings. So these are things like HVAC controls and other things, but not for private, but more commercial buildings. Data centers, all the rage right now, what's happening with AI data factories. Big part of that is us enabling the technology to build and run those factories on the back end. We have mobility, which is trains, which again, in the US is not such a big presence, but globally is. And then finally, software, the part that I'm responsible for. And so in our software, you've heard me talk already a lot about the idea of 3D models and all those kind of things to represent something. We call that the digital twin. What do we mean by a digital twin? A digital twin says that the closer I can make the virtual world to the real world, the more valuable it is to my customer. So for example, let's go back to that automobile. If I can build it in a 3D model, I can show you how it all goes together, all the nuts, the bolts and screws, everything in that. I started building a digital twin, and that's been around for years. What's changing now is people want that model to not just be, can it all go together? Which, by the way, is pretty much solved now. Yeah. The first time you put a vehicle together, it's going to go together because we've simulated every nut, bolt, screw, everything. We've simulated the robots and they're going to weld it. We've simulated the factory, everything about it. Right? You still find issues, of course, but it's much different than it was years ago when you first put it together. You'd have a ream of pages of information about all the interference problems and things like that, right? So wow. Kind of solve. But then people said, well, what about the functional characteristics of that vehicle? Is it going to accelerate like I expect? What's the noise, vibration, and handling of this vehicle going to be like? What's my braking going to look like when I apply the brakes? All these kind of things can all be simulated in what you do. So then you think about your smartwatch or your phone. Most of the phones and smartwatches in the world are designed and manufactured with our software today. Now think about that. It's mechanical because you got the structure of the phone or whatever, the watch, whatever.
Yeah.
You got electronics in there. You've got the integrated circuit that goes in. And we're one of three companies in the world that helps design and manufacture integrated circuits with our software. All three based in the United States, by the way, but we're one of those three. And then you've got electrical systems, electrical wiring, like in a vehicle, all wiring layout. You've got software that goes into the product and makes it run. You've got the manufacturing engineering of the product. You've got the layout of the factory. How are you going to produce it? How do you simulate it? So all of that is what I would call the digital twin. So now if I can simulate all these things, I'm a lot more confident. I can move a lot faster than anybody else because I can make decisions with confidence because they can prove it out what I'm doing, right? And the closer you can make that relationship, the more valuable it is because some of our competitors, for example, can't represent electronics. Well, that's not a really good digital twin if you can't do a major component.
Part of the job, yeah.
And so we've tried to integrate that better than anybody else to bring that together at Siemens. And then we provide that software to our customers. And you'd be hard pressed to find a customer that designs, builds, and manufactures something that doesn't have something to our software. Yeah, we have competitors that are out there, and we have some that use us more holistically than others. Some might use some of our components and not all, right? But generally, we're present in most companies, helping them build what we call a digital enterprise the ability to do that for them to simulate. And why is that so important? Think about COVID. During COVID, people couldn't get to their factories. They had to replan the factories. If you have a virtual factory, you can do it sitting at home on your computer and lay out the factory and simulate what's going on and make changes, right? If you're going to change the product line because COVID affected what you're going to produce, you can simulate all those things without having to be there in the factory all the time. It allowed those customers to move a lot faster than the ones that didn't. And that's why I think there's such a big investment in our kind of software today, because companies realize, boy, if I don't have that virtual capability, I'm going to run slower than the guy next to me. And so what we do at Siemens is really helping our customers create that digital enterprise to be able to move a lot faster than the competition.
Sure. Now that's, so really Siemens has their hands in just about every aspect of what we touch on a given day, is certainly what it sounds like with all the technologies that they're a part of.
So, but definitely the software, and then again, the factories that run and build and manufacture these things. And it's not just discrete hard physical products, it's also the process industry. So whether it's soap or oil or whatever else is produced, we have solutions for that as well.
Yeah. So being that industry leader and being kind of at the forefront of artificial intelligence from our previous discussion, how are you using AI to transform the industry apart from, you know, what we've said, where you guys are innovating data centers that are allowing people to use all of these new tools? What's Siemens doing to help continue to push that forward, and how are you utilizing it?
Yeah, I kind of put AI in three categories. There's the category of how do we use AI to help us run more efficiently in what we're doing and operate our business, whether it's HR, finance functions, or whatever. How do you use AI and software development to move faster? And then probably the most important part is how do we use AI in our applications to help our customers? And by the way, I travel all over the world every week and major companies, and I can tell you every single meeting I have today, the very first topic is AI. Every single time, because customers realize they got to be on top of this and they got to know where they're at, right? And so an example of the types of things that we do, if you've ever seen a turbine blade, you've seen them on airplanes, for example, the blades of the engine. There's turbine blades, for example, like in a gas turbine, for example, to produce electricity, right?
Sure.
In the case of a gas turbine, which is also a part of a Siemens business, it's called Siemens Energy, but we have ownership in it, but it's a separate company.
Okay.
We have some ownership, but they're a customer of ours as well with my software. And so if you think about, for example, that turbine blade operates above its melting point when it's running in the blade, right? So you've got to cool it very, very effectively. And so what you don't often see in turbine blades is there's holes inside that turbine blade to run fluid through to be able to keep it cooling for a time, right? Because of the extreme temperature. The better you can cool it, the more efficient it is, and the longer lasting that turbine blade will be. So back to our simulation software.
Yeah.
I can simulate the structural integrity of that blade, but I can also simulate the fluid flow going through that blade to see how is this thing going to cool based on the fluid rates, the fluid flow that we have, right? And so that's a process that traditionally has been done by the PhDs, the engineers that are specifically trained in the space of finite element analysis and so forth. And even there, they specialize in an area. You might have somebody that's really good at fluid dynamics, but maybe not as good as structural design.
Makes sense.
So you got to bring those pieces together to be able to simulate that. And you do a blade at a time, and it would take a while to do that. With AI now, I can do 1,000 blades in the time it took me to do one blade, right? Because I can use AI data, you can build kind of a neural network to be able to understand what's going on, and it starts making recommendations. And you know, even a half a percentage point of improvement efficiency is huge, enormous for a gas turbine that's going to run 24/7, right? To be able to be more efficient in the way it runs. And so when you think about that, the impact to our customers, that's enormous, because if your competitor is running 1,000 times faster than you and validating blades and you're not, it won't be long before your business is disrupted.
Right? You're lagging behind.
And then we have other examples where we're using AI agents, which help you do tasks. So for example, we have Rolls-Royce as one of our customers today that they design, build all their jet engines and so forth with our software. And we've worked with them to automate a lot of what's happening in their factory and so forth. And then you start getting this data, and then you can ask questions like, hey, what happened in the factory last night? And AI will come back and tell you, we've got a failure here. You say, well, okay, what's going on there? How many more systems do I like had that in the factory? what was the operational efficiency of that before it failed, so I can see if it's going to happen elsewhere. And it starts giving you all this data, and then it might make a recommendation as to, hey, this particular part is what you need to replace. Here's the recommended parts to replace. It actually starts creating the issue for you, tracks it, does it, and does some of the work with your guidance through this agent is guiding you through the process.
Yeah.
Now you can take young engineers that maybe don't have the experience, and suddenly they have all the experience of all the previous engineers that ever worked at Rolls-Royce in the history of Rolls-Royce and analyzing and understanding that problem, right? So I actually call it the great equalizer. What I mean by that is people say, well, it's going to be the haves and the have-nots. And I say, I see it differently. I see it as, it used to be certain countries or regions, you know, Germany, for example, was always known as the manufacturing experts, right?
Definitely.
Well, now the young kid in Indonesia has all the knowledge of all those engineers that ever designed and built anything in the world at their disposal. They're starting to use AI. Now, some of that is corporate proprietary type thing, but even inside their own company, being able to leverage that knowledge globally, right, to new people coming into the job, think how fast you can move with that. So that's really how we think about how we're leveraging AI.
Yeah, the great equalizer. That's a fantastic way to put it. I've never heard it quite put that way before, but no, that makes a lot of sense. And it's just very interesting how much more efficient you can make a business by you in your own business and utilizing these AI tools. Now, one of the things that I think gets overshadowed a little bit nowadays by the conversation of AI, it certainly does in our industry, and I'd be interested to hear about it in yours, but it is cloud technology and how you're using that similarly with AI and how you're leveraging the cloud to add extra value to your business and to your clients.
Yeah, so cloud, I always tease my team. I was doing cloud before cloud was cool. Back at CAD/CAM Incorporated, back in the mid-80s, late 80s, we did time sharing. So what that meant was you had a terminal. You remember at that time there weren't necessarily workstations or PCs yet. It was all running on mainframe or mini mainframe type computers that were there. And you had a terminal that didn't have any intelligence. It was just a display for you to interact. And so we started time sharing those things out of Dayton, Ohio. And we had fairly large customers at that time. Northrop, for example, he was tied into these systems. And the reason was, people couldn't afford necessarily the big full mainframe or mini on the back end.
Yeah.
And they didn't have the expertise to run it and so forth. So we did all of that, and they just tied them through phone lines.
And interesting.
Those phone lines were 9.6 KB phone lines or 56 KB. To put it in perspective, your internet connection is probably close to about 10,000 times faster than that. So think about how
a little bit quicker.
Right. But yet it still worked because we were able to do 2D drawings and things. You couldn't do all the crazy stuff we do today, but you could do a lot of good stuff at that time, right? And so in some ways, that's what cloud, and we managed the software for them. Mm-hmm. We did all the backups of their data. We trained them. Everything. All they did was come in and use it, and they paid for usage. That's what cloud and SaaS enable, software as a service. Software as a service runs over the cloud where I run it, I manage it, I take care of it for my customer. And so that can save them great deals of money in operational cost. And we've companies that we've reduced their cost 50% just because we're running it, managing it for them rather than having out their own team.
Yeah, yeah, that's exceptional.
But it's also, your software is always up to date. It's always current. We can learn from it. We can learn how you're using the software and make recommendations. For AI to really work, you need the data. If you don't have the data, AI it's never going to get to where you need to be. So we use some of that data. Now, like customer data is important. It's their data. We respect the privacy of that data. And we use something called retrieval augmented generation, which basically says your data stays private to you. And then there's other data that we leverage as more general data that we use to help you in your environment. But the cloud is how we do that, right? And then the next part of that is how do we make AI and the cloud leveraging it, our cloud leveraging AI to be more engineering speak rather than today. Most of it is text and video and all those things we're all used to. We're doing a lot of work at Siemens to make sure it understands the language of engineering and manufacturing as well.
Yeah.
But cloud, back to your comment, is a key enabler. And then the last thing it does for us, it helps us reach a whole new set of customers we couldn't reach before. What do I mean by that? If you implemented Teamcenter, the big companies like the Fords, whatever, yeah, they could afford it. They had people that ran the database. They did everything, right? They had the support to do that. If you were a 5-man shop, there was no way I could put Teamcenter. No way. Yeah. But now, because I run it and you just use it, you pay for usage, I can go to very small customers. They have full value of that product. And so now we've increased our addressable market by being able to go after a bunch of customers traditionally you have not been able to reach because of not having the cloud.
Yeah, that's exceptional. I mean, especially when you think about the innovation that can come from those smaller companies that you might otherwise not have seen or not have been able to reach. So that's fantastic. And you addressed it a little bit there when you were answering my question on the cloud. But security and trust, you know, that's such an important part of the world now with AI, with cloud computing, and so many people are concerned about it. So what does Siemens do to kind of address that? You said that a lot of that personal information for individual companies stays that way. Are there specific measures that you guys have to take to ensure the cybersecurity of what you do?
Well, even before cloud, we were constantly getting pressured by our customers. These are large defense companies. These are large high-tech companies. In fact, it was interesting. I was with one high-tech company. I can't give the name of the company. They won't allow me to talk about the fact that they use our software. But
no problem.
If you can imagine, one of the biggest producers of some of those ideas I talked about with phones and watches and so forth. So I'll stop there, but I think you can kind of understand. But I was talking to them one time, talking about how secure our software is for what we do with things like defense programs and so forth. Mm-hmm. And they laughed and they said, yeah, well, our security is even tighter than that, right? And so we've invested a great deal in security in what we do. You're never finished there, of course, right? And nothing's perfectly secure by any means. But we've invested a great deal there. And then with cloud, it's to a new level of what we do. And again, we, Siemens, a large company, we have a cybersecurity team that helps us across the company, that helps us with software as well and what we do. But we kind of think of it at two levels. One is the part I just spoke to you about, retrieval augmented generation, which says your data stays private to you, doesn't go to the rest of the way in the cloud. And then inside your own company, though, you have to protect data as well, because you know not everybody gets to see the latest design of this auto or airplane or whatever you're building come out, right? And then also, when you have complex programs, like some of our aerospace companies where you've got a very large supply chain, or automotive where you've got a supply chain where they're all using your data, they're connected to your system, and a one vehicle program, the two tier one OEMs that supply you components are working as a partnership, on the next vehicle program, they're in competition with each other. So you have to be able to protect the data not only inside a company, but all different kinds of different levels. And we've spent a lot of money to do that. And so, again, you're never able to say you're totally secure. But I would also say that if there's anything that has learned over the years is when companies think, well, I can't trust a hyperscaler like an AWS or someone like this to manage my data in particular. These are the companies that somehow think their own IT organization is somehow better than that. Generally, they're not.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
Most of the occurrences occur when somebody thinks they're good because they're good themselves, instead of maybe relying on the experts that do it very, very well as well. And so I think it's something you're never finished with. And we invest a great deal there. We also leverage our partners like AWS and Microsoft Azure and others that we work with to take advantage of what they have in security as well.
Definitely. No, that's incredibly interesting. That's like I said, a topic that we constantly hear about is cybersecurity with these tools. So now that's very, very interesting. And to kind of segue into one of our last topics here, just talking about your career in general, we've covered some of the basics from where you started to how you got to where you are. But are there any leadership principles that have guided you through all of that change through your career that have led to where you're at now?
Well, again, if you think there was some laid out plan as to how I got to this job. There's lots of things that occurred and you could have taken a different fork and it would have went in maybe a different direction. But I mean, look, you got to work hard. You got to do the job you're assigned to do and do it well. I think taking risk is important. There's many times, like when I went to run Europe the first few months, you're thinking, what did I do? It wasn't easy moving and all the issues you deal with and everything. But then you look back and you say, well, that was the right thing to do. There's never been one of these where I've taken it, where I look backwards and say, yeah, that was not something I should have done. Or you learn from it, you move on with it. But I also, my own personal opinion, I'm not saying this works for everybody, it's different for lots of people, is I believe that the risk should be tangential, meaning, okay, if you're going to do something, leverage what you already know and do today into that role versus jumping completely into something brand new. And the only reason I say that was your value is leveraging that experiences you've had that differentiates you from somebody else. So if you jump into something new, you're not leveraging anything, not as much at least, just my own personal opinion. I know people have done both and they can do it easily, but I think these tangential moves, take the risk when you need to, try it. Like I said, I never wanted to be a salesperson. Before you knew it, I was running worldwide sales globally for us, right? And you did it and you figured out what you had to do. But I think as far as just management, kind of something my dad told me many years ago when I first started managing people. He worked in a factory and he was a foreman of people. And his general principle was, which many people know and have heard before, is never ask someone to do something you wouldn't do yourself. Right? Yeah. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. If you're not willing to take it on yourself, how can you ask somebody else to do it? Right. And I think the other part is building trust and being as fair as possible. Look, if there's anything I've learned with 28,000 people in your organization, you're not going to please everybody. There's always somebody that's upset about something, right? And that takes a little while to get used to, because you think, well, why isn't everybody agreeing, right? They never will. And if you think they will, you're kidding yourself. They won't, right? And so you just have to try to, in my opinion, be as fair as possible. No one can accuse you of doing the wrong thing if you're being fair and what's doing right for the company, what you think is right for the organization. Easier said than done, but that's kind of weird how I would think about it.
So if you had to give just one of those as a piece of advice to a young person that's just starting out, going into technology or going to whatever career path for that matter, what is the one thing that you tell them? Is it hard work or is it the one
thing? I think you got to work hard and look for the right opportunity. Sometimes patience, right? Maybe I get so many people to come to me and say, I want something different. I want to try something new. And it's, well, let's work on it. It may not happen tomorrow. It may happen a little bit later. And sometimes it's a move that maybe looks tangential. I mean, there's been twice in my career where I was managing hundreds of people and I left and went to another company and I was a one-man show by myself. And then eventually start managing a group again, right? And so, look, a lot of this is luck, right place, right time. But you got to work hard to create your own luck. Otherwise, you won't be ready for it. You won't be there. So I think it's mostly just work hard at the job you're in and then those opportunities will come to you. Your management or anybody else, they're going to see you and say, hey, this person knows what they're doing. And the last part of it is to speak up, right? And there's a delicate balance there. Know when to speak up and when to maybe be quiet. But if you've got something and you feel firm about it, you know it's the right thing, you should speak up. But don't say things that are foolish and silly that you just want to hear yourself talk, right? Speak up when you got something that you know can make a difference for the business. Align yourself to the business. I see a lot of people go take special jobs for a while. That's fine for a little while. You don't want to be stuck there. You want to be in the line of fire, right? You want to be in the business, right in with the customer in the line of fire, because that's where you learn the most, in my opinion. Yeah, those other jobs can be okay for a while, but don't get stuck there. If you're stuck there too long, then you won't get out of it.
That's very interesting. No, I think that's great advice, especially to anybody getting started or making a career change. So that's incredible. And the last thing I want to wrap up with, we talked about a lot today. We covered a lot of different things, but is there one piece of technology going into the future that you're truly excited about that you can't wait to see how it turns out? Or is it just technology in general?
Actually, there's three. I mean, I say this all the time to people, for young people today, I think there's three things that will greatly affect their lives. Mm-hmm. One is AI, which we've already talked about. And by the way, I've seen lots of tech and other things that have been overhyped, whatever. There may be a bubble in AI right now with how many people building data centers and so forth, but the concept of AI is not overhyped. I mean, it's rapidly expanding. And I think it'll change forever the way we think about everything. So AI is one. Second is nuclear fusion. And the third is quantum computing. And what do I mean by that? If any one of these three things hit, the world's a completely different place. If you have unlimited energy, cheap energy with nuclear fusion, totally think about everything changes.
Well, absolutely.
Quantum computing, but if I can simulate, I mean, quantum can simulate the entire human brain, it can simulate the world. I mean, all these kind of things, the simulation, unlimited compute. So you got unlimited power, unlimited compute, and unlimited AI. If any one of those hit, the world's completely different. If all three hit, it's probably a world that you and I can't imagine right now. And the likelihood of all three of those hitting is fairly high. Yeah, we've been talking about quantum computing for a while, but over the next 20 years, something will happen. I just was at CES with one of our customers doing nuclear fusion. They're doing prototypes already at the end of this year and so forth. And again, and AI where it's at. So chances are these things will happen. And I think it'll be a totally, totally different world.
That's incredible. And I appreciate your insight. So Tony, this has been a very inspiring conversation. Your insights, your leadership, innovation are all invaluable, not just for our business, but for all leaders around the world today. So thank you so much for joining us. Again, I appreciate everything that you've done for us today, and it's been a very, very interesting conversation. And to all of our listeners, thank you for tuning into the Next Gen podcast. Join us next time as we continue to explore ideas that shape the future of wealth, leadership, and until then, stay focused, stay inspired. Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Next Gen podcast. To learn more about our team and to join our exclusive educational events throughout the year, check out our website at advisors.ubs.com/Energen. If you have any suggestions on episodes you'd like to hear, let us know by emailing us at energen@ubs.com. And if you liked this episode, be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify to hear more. This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of any offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we recommend listeners to obtain appropriate and independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Incorporated offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct our business and that you carefully read agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products and services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Incorporated is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.
This podcast was edited by Resonate Recordings.